Ruin had seemed inevitable. Yet there it was, a huge Union army slinking back into Washington's defenses, while the ragged boys in butternut and gray stood magnificent and bloody and triumphant on the field. Though the name of James Longstreet was spoken reverently, the clear heroes of the day were Lee and Jackson. Lee was the mastermind, the great solemn presence and genius of war, whose strategies had driven not one but two federal armies from Virginia within 2 months. Jackson was Lee's iron fist, his righteous tool of destruction. Southerners saw it that way. They also saw the two generals quite accurately as a team. The two men thought alike and acted in concert. Lee trusted Jackson, alone of his generals, to make his own decisions. The nearly miraculous linking of the two armies near Manassas on the morning of August 29 was not only the culmination of one of the war's most brilliant tactical maneuvers, it also was the product of a sort of high command teamwork not previously witnessed on either side. The Richmond Whig put it this way. The central figure of the war is, beyond question, that of Robert E. Lee. His the calm, broad military intellect that reduced the chaos after Donelson to form and order. But Jackson is the motive power that executes, with the rapidity of lightning, all that Lee can plan. Lee is the exponent of Southern power of command, Jackson the expression of its faith in God and in itself, its terrible energy, its enthusiasm and daring, its unconquerable will, its contempt of danger and fatigue. Meanwhile, the stories of Jackson's march around Pope were passing quickly into legend. Everywhere he went now, people wanted to see and touch him. Men wanted to shake his hand and speak to him. Children pressed as close as they dared when he passed. At Martinsburg, Virginia, he rode down the town's main street to tumultuous cheers, and women clustered around him and actually managed to cut off buttons from his coat. Some of them screamed for locks of his hair, to which the blushing general replied, "Really, ladies, this is the first time I was ever surrounded by the enemy." When he sought refuge in a hotel, citizens surrounded the place, rattling the doors and windows. Even as his poor horse, Little Sorrel, was being stripped of his hair by souvenir hunters. Jackson, who disliked such adulation, escaped it only by setting up a secret headquarters outside of town. In Frederick, Maryland, despite an otherwise chilly reception by the town's mostly non-slave-owning, pro-Union citizens, Jackson was ambushed in the street by two bright Baltimore girls who had concealed themselves in his carriage. One took his hand, while the other threw her arms around him, according to Henry Kidd Douglas, and talked with the wildest enthusiasm until he simply seemed miserable. A few minutes later, the young ladies rode off, leaving him there bowing, blushing, and speechless. Jackson, fearing another such encounter, did not venture out again until late in the evening. That same day in Frederick, Jeb Stuart's chief of staff, Heroes von Bork, experienced what it was like to be mistaken for the famous Stonewall Jackson. Von Bork wrote later, "All remonstrances with the crowd were utterly useless. I was very soon followed by a wild mob of people of all ages, from the old graybeard down to the smallest boy, all insisting that I was Jackson, and venting their admiration in loud cheers and huzzas. Ladies rushed out of their houses with bouquets. To escape these annoying ovations, I dismounted at last at a hotel, but here I was little better off. It was like jumping in the mill pond to get out of the rain." Some of Jackson's enemies, too, were swept up in this wave of national adulation. A short time later, as he was riding by a large body of captive Union soldiers, "almost the whole mass of prisoners broke over us and rushed to the road," wrote one South Carolina soldier. "They threw up their hats, cheered, roared, bellowed, as even Jackson's troops had scarcely ever done." The general gave a stiff acknowledgment of the compliment, pulled down his hat, drove spurs into his horse, and went clattering down the hill away from the noise. It is hard to know how his new celebrity struck him. Perhaps he really could not tolerate the idea that he, and not God, was getting credit for his victories. Perhaps, too, as his brother-in-law D.H. Hill theorized, what bothered him most was the temptation he felt, the warring of his own desires. Maybe some part of him liked being famous. Maybe that was what bothered him. The notion of Lee and Jackson as invincible warriors had more practical effects. It gave new hope and inspiration to many northern anti-war Democrats and Lincoln opponents whose vision of an endless, bloody, and unaffordable war was starting to look more and more real. European leaders had followed each turn of the Virginia campaign with rapt interest, and the Confederate victories had convinced many of them that Lincoln would never be able to restore the Union by force of arms. With their triumph at Second Manassas, Lee and Jackson, who became overnight folk heroes in Europe, had made the case for de facto Confederate independence. All that remained now, many influential Europeans believed, was to formally acknowledge that state of affairs, either by an offer of mediation or outright diplomatic recognition, or both. A majority in the House of Commons, saddled by a Union blockade with a cotton famine that had left three-fourths of British cotton mill workers unemployed or working part-time, clearly favored it, as did rising numbers of ordinary Britons. The British Prime Minister, Lord Palmerston, who had blocked a parliamentary resolution favoring mediation in June, now seemed ready to accept the idea. The Union had received a complete smashing at Second Manassas, he wrote Lord John Russell, and it seems not altogether unlikely that still greater disasters await them, and that even Washington or Baltimore might fall into the hands of the Confederates. The French seemed to be leaning Richmond's way, too. That summer, Emperor Louis Napoleon seriously considered a Southern alliance in exchange for cotton, and told his foreign secretary to ask the English government, if the moment has not come, to recognize the South. By September, according to the French Foreign Secretary, not a reasonable statesman in Europe believed the North could win. Confederate diplomat John Slidell, riding this wave of pro-Southern feeling, said, "I am more hopeful of recognition than I have been at any moment since my arrival." Even better, there was clear American historical precedent for all this. Colonial victory over Great Britain in the Second Battle of Saratoga in 1777 was a turning point in the Revolutionary War and led directly to French recognition of American independence and subsequent intervention on the American side. All this was in play as never before when Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson, James Longstreet, and the Army of Northern Virginia tramped north. The Confederate army that splashed across the Potomac River into Maryland on September 4 and 5 fresh from its victories in the 7 days and at Cedar Mountain and Second Manassas, shocked the civilians who saw it. "They were the roughest set of creatures I ever saw," wrote a correspondent for the Baltimore American. "Their features, hair, and clothing matted with dirt and filth, and the scratching they kept up gave warrant of vermin in abundance. Many were without shoes, their uniforms so tattered they barely held together, their slouch hats so riddled with tears and holes that their greasy hair protruded from them at odd and comical angles. They stunk so badly, many had not even removed their clothing in weeks, that it was said you could smell the vaunted Army of Northern Virginia long before you could see it. The most striking thing about the men was their gauntness, the startling hollowness of eyes and cheeks and chests. Many were malnourished. Most suffered from diarrhea brought on by everything from poor sanitation to bad water to a steady diet of roasted green corn and green apples. They were victims of the long and unreliable supply line that stretched all the way to Richmond, victims, too, of the Confederate military withdrawal from central Tennessee, where most of the South's pork was produced, and of the severe summer drought that had ruined the corn crop in several states. As always, Lee's men were poorly armed. By Union standards, what they carried across the river with them was just as unsettling as their beggarly appearance. Fully 30% of their muskets were still the antiquated 69-caliber smoothbores. There were also large numbers of 54-caliber muskets, three types, in fact, including some models that dated from 1841. Some were captured Springfield 58-calibers, and the balance, most, were imported British-made 577-caliber Enfields. A requisition from Jackson's command in the fall of 1862 listed 20,000 69-caliber cartridges and 40,000 58-caliber cartridges. their batteries were woefully inferior, too. Not only did they possess vastly fewer rifled guns than the Union, but also some 20% of their cannons were ancient, model 1841 six-pounders. The quality of their fuses was often atrocious. Many shells either failed to burst or burst prematurely. A good number exploded while still in the guns. Lastly, for anyone who could see it, the army that marched up into Maryland was simply not the same one that had departed from the vicinity of Washington just a few days before. Lee approached the river with 50,000 to 55,000 men, a force that had been replenished by Richmond after Second Manassas. 12 days later, he had less than 40,000. The cause was straggling on an unprecedented scale. Some of the men fell away for lack of shoes, some because of illness or diarrhea or malnourishment. Many wanted nothing to do with an invasion of the North. They were fighting only to protect their homeland as they saw it, only to repel the invader. But straggling didn't quite cover what was going on. A lot of this was outright desertion by men who'd had a bellyful of fighting and marching and suffering. The Union, too, was experiencing straggling at record levels. Union General-in-Chief Henry Halleck was so frustrated by it that he wrote McClellan to suggest that shooting them while in the act of straggling from their commands is the only effective remedy. McClellan himself complained that the states of the North are flooded with deserters and absentees. Strangest of all, perhaps, was that the undernourished, lice-infested troops who stayed with the army were remarkably happy. Morale was high. Hopes were high. They were fully conscious of their new fame. The name of the Army of Northern Virginia was now known to the whole world. They were the heroes of the Confederacy, and they knew it. In spite of great disparities in troop strength and in quality of weapons, ammunition, and supplies, from the start of war to the present, First Manassas, Jackson's Valley Campaign, Seven Pines, 7 Days, Cedar Mountain, and Second Manassas, the Yankees had not beaten them. They had a sense, moreover, that one more big victory might change everything. When they crossed the river at White's Ford, near Leesburg, they did so, in the words of one of Jackson's soldiers, with great enthusiasm, bands playing, men singing and cheering. The regimental band was playing Maryland, My Maryland, a pro-Southern song that portrayed Lincoln as a tyrant. The despot's heel is on thy shore, Maryland. His torch is at thy temple door, Maryland. Even old Jack got caught up in the excitement, removing his hat while the band played, and once on the other side, accepting gifts from Confederate sympathizers of a powerful gray mare and a prize melon. The mysterious new land they were entering, Maryland, was a slave state that had not seceded and thus remained divided in its loyalties. Just how divided, no one knew for sure. It had been an article of faith among Confederate officialdom that the state was ripe for conversion. They believed that their troops would be welcomed with open arms by a people who had felt the heavy hand of a federal government that had occupied it militarily, arrested its citizens and legislators without warrants or charges, and suppressed its newspapers and rights of free speech. Lincoln had done all that and more while trying to keep Maryland in the Union. But the Confederates were wrong, especially in the town of Frederick, where they arrived on September 6. Able-bodied men did not throng to their ranks. There was no uprising or movement to force Maryland to join the Confederacy. The majority of citizens treated them coldly and fearfully, having made sure to hide their money and valuables. But that would not change Lee's plans. With the knowledge that McClellan's army was on its way to intercept him, he had an idea for yet another daring maneuver whose key player, once again, was Stonewall Jackson. As the rebel army moved north, Lee had worried about 2 Union garrisons in his rear, one at Harper's Ferry with 10,400 men, and one at nearby Martinsburg with 2,500. Left alone, this force, the size of a full army corps, would menace both Lee's supply lines and his escape routes. As anyone who had ever been there knew, Harper's Ferry was extremely vulnerable, a custom-made trap wedged into the delta formed by the confluence of 2 great rivers, with mountains rising as high as 1,000 feet on 3 sides. Harper's Ferry had been Jackson's first command. He knew its weaknesses better than anyone. On September 9, Lee, camped at Frederick, Maryland, decided to divide his army and send part of it to capture Harper's Ferry. He had done so in consultation with Jackson, who was very much in favor of the plan, and had based it on the assumption that McClellan would move with his typical slowness. That would allow Jackson to reunite with Lee and Longstreet before McClellan caught up. Longstreet, who had opposed the idea, later recalled that he came upon Lee and Jackson together, eagerly plotting the destruction of the Union garrison. Seeing the enthusiasm of his colleagues, he yielded. "They had gone so far that it seemed useless for me to offer any further opposition," he wrote, "and I only suggested that Lee should use his entire army in the move." Lee's decision was embodied in a fateful 10-paragraph directive dated September 9 and known as Special Orders 191. In it, he split his army into 4 pieces, 3 of them under Jackson, consisting of 26 of the Army's 40 brigades, were to march to Harper's Ferry, where they would surround and attack the garrison simultaneously from 3 directions. Because of the ferry's peculiar terrain, the 3 would have to take entirely separate routes. General Lafayette McLaw's division, 5,000 men, would secure Maryland Heights on the Maryland side. Brigadier General John Walker, with his 2-brigade division, less than 4,000 men, would secure Loudoun Heights across the Shenandoah River in Virginia. And Jackson's 3 divisions, 14,000 men, with a long march around to the west, would seal off Harper's Ferry by seizing Bolivar Heights. Longstreet, with the rest of the army, would march west through the Blue Ridge South Mountain to the town of Boonesboro, using D.H. Hill as his rear guard against attack through the mountains. Special Orders 191's flaw was immediately obvious. For as long as it took for Jackson to seize the Union garrison at Harper's Ferry, the rest of Lee's army, merely 16,000 men, would be isolated and at the mercy of the entire Army of the Potomac. Thus Lee gave Jackson just 3 days to get the job done. Once in the vicinity of Harper's Ferry, Jackson's forces deployed quickly. After a sharp fight, McLaws seized Maryland Heights from the 1,600 Federals whom Union Commander Dixon Miles had stationed there on the morning of September 13. That afternoon, Walker took the undefended Loudoun Heights. Jackson, meanwhile, moved his forces in on the western flank of the town and began to set his artillery in position. Jackson, the old artillerist, with the immense advantages offered by the spectacular headlands around Harper's Ferry, was planning a big-gun assault from 3 directions on the roughly 13,000 Federals below. The Martinsburg garrison had retreated before Jackson's advance and joined the other Union troops. Though Jackson was a day behind schedule, and McClellan was already at Frederick, Lee did not yet see any reason to panic. McClellan was McClellan, after all. Except, of course, when he was in possession of the greatest intelligence leak of the Civil War. That same day, a corporal from Indiana, named Barton Mitchell, found an envelope containing a sheet of paper wrapped around 3 cigars. The cigars were of excellent quality, something enlisted men rarely got to sample. Before lighting up, Mitchell and another soldier decided to take a closer look at the document. It was addressed to D.H. Hill, contained the names of prominent Confederate generals, and closed with, "By command of R.E. Lee." It was signed by Lee's adjutant, R.H. Chilton. News of the find quickly climbed the chain of command. Soon, Major General Alpheus Williams, commanding the Union 12th Corps, was peering at Special Orders 191, a document that appeared to provide in elaborate detail the movements, whereabouts, and precise strategy of the entire Army of Northern Virginia. The order was so detailed, precise, and comprehensive, in fact, rare in the war, that some of its original Confederate recipients had taken action to prevent just such a leak. Longstreet had put it in his mouth and chewed it up like a plug of tobacco. Walker had pinned it to the inside of his jacket. Jackson had meticulously burned it. It was a stroke of luck that General Williams's aide, Colonel Samuel Pittman, who had known Chilton well in pre-war Army days, could confirm that it was Lee's chief of staff's handwriting. McClellan understood immediately what he had. After reading it, he threw his hands in the air and exclaimed, "Now I know what to do." Later that same day, he was in his tent, chatting with his old Army friend, Brigadier General John Gibbon, and another officer, when he pulled the folded orders from his pocket. "Here is a paper with which, if I cannot whip Bobby Lee, I would be willing to go home," he told them. "It gives the movement of every division of Lee's army." He then vowed to put Lee in a position he will find hard to get out of, and noted that Castiglione will be nothing to it. His reference was to the Battle of Castiglione in Italy in 1796, in which Napoleon Bonaparte famously routed an Austrian army. The message of 191 was perfectly clear. Lee had divided his army, and his separated units could thus be attacked and beaten in detail. It was probably the greatest single military opportunity of the war. McClellan wired Lincoln, saying, "I think Lee has made a gross mistake, and that he will be severely punished for it. I have all the plans of the rebels and will catch them in their own trap if my men are equal to the emergency." At about 5 p.m. that same day, Jeb Stuart received a provocative piece of intelligence. A Confederate sympathizer happened to be standing near McClellan's tent when he had received the copy of Special Orders 191 and had described McClellan's reaction. Though the spy did not fully understand what had happened, it was clear that McClellan certainly knew something. Stuart immediately sent a courier to Lee with the news, then sent another dispatch at about midnight on the same subject. Since the message has been lost, it is impossible to say what Stuart told Lee or what Lee suspected, though it is unlikely that Lee knew McClellan had a copy of the order itself. But he would soon be very aware that McClellan was not behaving in his usual way. That change was visible the very next day. Lee, who had told Brigadier General G. John Walker on September 6 that McClellan would not be prepared for offensive operations for 3 weeks, now watched in amazement on September 14 as McClellan's army pushed its way forward through three passes in South Mountain, the elevated, elongated north-to-south running formation that marked the extension of the Blue Ridge Mountains into Maryland. There were pitched battles that day at Turner's Gap and Fox's Gap, where D.H. Hill fought a fierce rearguard action, and Crampton's Gap, where a vastly outnumbered Lafayette McLaws, who was also manning the guns on nearby Maryland Heights, tried to hold back William Franklin's Sixth Corps, whose mission was to relieve Harper's Ferry. In all, some 28,000 Union troops faced some 18,000 rebels. The Confederate purpose was not to win, but to delay the federal advance long enough for Jackson to come up from Harper's Ferry. They very definitely did not win. By the end of the day, they were blown out of all three passes, suffering 2,685 casualties to the Union's 2,385. They did, however, buy Lee precious time. Even though the Union commanders knew with certainty that Lee's weakened and divided army lay before them, none pushed aggressively forward. Franklin, headed for the ferry with 12,300 men, came to a complete standstill. McClellan, moving through the northern passes, and suspicious that Longstreet's main force lay just ahead, slowed to a crawl. Though Special Orders 191 had specified troop movements, the document had said nothing about troop strength, which meant that McClellan could indulge his usual wild fantasies. "The Battle of South Mountain was one of extraordinary illusions and delusions," wrote D.H. Hill. "The Federals were under the self-imposed illusion that there was a very large force opposed to them, whereas there was only one weak division until late afternoon at Turner's and Fox's Gaps. They might have brushed it aside almost without halting." McClellan believed, and he had taught his more cautious generals to believe, that the greatest threat came from what they could not see, from those phantom army corps lying in wait in the next valley or wooded grove, warming themselves by 10,000 campfires and waiting to fall upon his outnumbered army. For the moment, he was triumphant, and he wasted no time in trumpeting his achievement to his bosses in Washington. "It has been a glorious victory," he telegraphed, and followed it the next morning with two more dispatches, saying that the enemy was retreating in a perfect panic, and that General Lee last night stated publicly that he must admit they had been shockingly whipped. It is stated that Lee gives his loss at 15,000. He did not mention the rumors that were sweeping his army that Lee and Longstreet were dead. McClellan had the rebels on the run. He knew for certain that Jackson was still in Harper's Ferry. His great opportunity to destroy Lee had come at last. Lee was not the only one who was surprised at the sudden and suddenly aggressive Union advance. That same day on the west side of Harper's Ferry, Jackson still believed he had plenty of time to finish his mission. He had instructed both McLaws and Walker not to open fire unless forced to. His plan was to ask for surrender, then wait 24 hours to see what Union Commander Colonel Dixon Miles would do. But as the day progressed, and the sounds of battle rose from the passes at South Mountain, it became clear to General Walker on Loudoun Heights, who could hear all this and even see some of it, that this plan would not hold. He had wigwagged a message to tell Jackson about the battle taking place at Crampton's Gap, which Jackson had dismissed as a minor cavalry fight. But Walker could hear the artillery that Jackson could not, which left no doubt in my mind, he wrote, of the advance of the whole Federal Army. Walker then contrived to be forced to open fire. He promptly placed two of his regiments on the treeless crest of the mountain, in full view of the Federal batteries on Bolivar Heights. "As I expected, they opened at once a heavy but harmless fire," Walker wrote. "I directed my batteries to reply." Soon, McLaws's batteries began banging away from across the river, and Jackson's followed. The Confederate cannonade kept up all afternoon, while the Federals quickly learned that you could not win an artillery fight with an opponent whose guns were positioned at much higher elevations. As one Federal soldier described it, "The infernal screech owls came hissing and singing, then bursting, plowing great holes in the earth, filling our eyes with dust, and tearing many giant trees to atoms." It was a convincing display, both to Jackson's forces and to the men who were ducking the shellfire below. When Walker later admitted his ruse to Jackson, Jackson replied, "It was just as well, but I could not believe that the fire you reported indicated the advance of McClellan in force. It seemed more likely to be merely a cavalry affair." Jackson was silent for a few moments, then added, "I thought I knew McClellan, but this movement puzzles me." Back in Hagerstown, an equally puzzled Lee was growing more and more despondent. His troops had been defeated and driven back at South Mountain by an inexplicably energetic Union army, and still he had heard nothing from Jackson. By the evening of September 13, he had decided he could no longer stay where he was. He would have to retreat. At 8 p.m., he sent a courier to Lafayette McLaws, commanding by far the closest and most accessible of the three units assailing Harper's Ferry, saying, "The day has gone against us, and this army, Longstreet's corps, will go to Sharpsburg to cross the river." He ordered McLaws to get back to Virginia as fast as he could. Then, just as all of Lee's plans seemed to be falling apart, he received a dispatch from Jackson. "Through God's blessing, the advance, which commenced this evening, has been successful thus far, and I look to him for complete success tomorrow. The advance has been directed to be resumed at dawn." Because Lee trusted Jackson's judgment, he believed him implicitly, this changed everything. New orders went out. McLaws and the rest of the army were now to coalesce at the little town of Sharpsburg, a mile or so north of the Potomac. The next morning, Jackson quickly made good on his promise. At dawn on September 15, he opened up with everything he had on the mist-shrouded town of Harper's Ferry. On Maryland and Loudoun Heights, 50 guns shattered the morning's calm and rained shell and shot, while Jackson's own carefully placed guns blasted the Federal troops and batteries on Bolivar Heights from three sides. The Federal return fire sputtered on erratically for a while, then stopped altogether. At about 8 a.m., as Jackson was readying his 14,000 for an advance against Miles's roughly comparable force, a rider emerged from the Federal lines holding a white flag of surrender. Though 1,300 cavalry had managed to escape under cover of darkness before, Jackson soon had as his prisoners 12,415 Union soldiers, 13,000 small arms, 73 cannons, 200 wagons, 1,200 mules, and a trove of supplies. He had done it all at a cost of 39 Confederates killed and 247 wounded, mostly at the Battle for Maryland Heights. Though little blood was spilled, Harper's Ferry was, on paper, the most comprehensive Confederate victory of the war. It was the largest surrender of Federal troops, larger in numbers than the surrender of British generals Cornwallis or Burgoyne in the Revolutionary War. The defeat was so humiliating that when news of it was released in Washington, War Department censors cut the numbers of Union soldiers captured in half. Jackson immediately sent a courier to Lee with the good news. "Through God's blessing," he wrote with the sort of understatement that was missing from his West Point classmates' self-congratulatory bombast, "Harper's Ferry and its garrison are to be surrendered." Lee was ecstatic. He ordered Jackson's note to be read to his army. Then he wired Davis in Richmond, saying, "This victory of the indomitable Jackson and his troops gives us renewed occasion for gratitude to Almighty God for his guidance and protection." The Union surrender that followed provided one of the war's most theatrical spectacles. "The entire garrison of 13,000 men was drawn up in imposing lines," wrote Heros von Bork, "presenting, with their well-kept equipments, their new uniforms and beautiful banners, a striking contrast to Jackson's gaunt and ragged soldiers who formed opposite to them, and whose tattered garments and weather-beaten features showed only too plainly the hardships they had undergone." When the mythical Jackson himself rode into Harper's Ferry with his staff at about 11 a.m., Union soldiers and other observers were stunned by his shoddy appearance. "He was dressed in the coarsest kind of homespun, seedy and dirty at that," wrote a correspondent for the New York Times, with no attempt to conceal his withering contempt. "He wore an old hat, which any northern beggar would consider an insult to have offered him, and in general appearance was in no respect to be distinguished from the mongrel, barefooted crew who follow his fortunes. And yet they glory in their shame." The contrast became even more marked when the ranking Union officer, Brigadier General Julius White, rode up with A.P. Hill and Drew Rein in front of Jackson. Garrison Commander Dixon Miles had been wounded in the leg by one of Jackson's shells and would die the next day. In contrast to his rebel counterpart, White was handsomely uniformed and mounted on a splendid black horse. Jackson offered him no terms but unconditional surrender, but he also made generous concessions, partly dictated by necessity. Captured soldiers would be paroled, not imprisoned, which meant they could walk away without their weapons. Enlisted men were allowed to keep their overcoats and blankets and were given 2 days' provisions. Officers would retain their sidearms and baggage. While Jackson was gathering his spoils and once again allowing the men free rein with the non-alcoholic supplies, a drama was unfolding 5 miles away in the valley below Crampton's Gap. Early that morning, Major General William Franklin and his 20,000 bluecoats had streamed down out of the pass on South Mountain in pursuit of their objective, the relief of Harper's Ferry. Special Orders 191 had told McClellan exactly where Jackson was and what he would be doing, and Franklin was going to save Harper's Ferry. Together, the garrison plus Franklin's corps would field some 33,000 men, almost as many as in Lee's entire army. Facing Franklin were Lafayette McLaws's paltry 5,000. As McLaws's men prepared to be crushed by the obviously superior force, they could hear the roll of Jackson's artillery in the distance. "Up in the valley we could see heavy masses of infantry bearing down on us," wrote Confederate cavalry officer W.W. Blackford, "their lines of skirmishers extending clear across from mountain to mountain as they came hastening down to the relief of their beleaguered garrison." On they came, until those skirmishers arrived within musket range of the Confederate lines. But just as the inevitable clash was about to occur, the reverberating roar of Jackson's guns stopped. The Union soldiers stopped, too, seemingly intrigued by the sudden silence. Then, as everyone stood frozen, came a sound, distant at first, then louder and louder as it rolled up the valley and through the Confederate ranks. It was the sound of wild cheering. The rebels had finally understood the meaning of the silence. Harper's Ferry had surrendered. A short time later, a courier arrived on a foaming horse to confirm the news. As the rebel yell rang through the Confederate column, a Yankee skirmisher stood up on a stone wall and yelled, "What the hell are you fellas cheering for?" A rebel soldier shouted back, "Because Harper's Ferry's gone up, goddamn you." To which the Union soldier replied, "I thought that was it." Maybe it was those rolling rebel cheers. Maybe it was Jackson himself, or once again the idea of Jackson, unbeaten, mysteriously powerful, and fresh from another bloody meal of Union soldiery. But for some reason, Franklin, in the middle of his McClellan-ordered advance on Harper's Ferry, simply gave up. At 11 a.m., he told McClellan, "They outnumber me 2-1. It will, of course, not answer to pursue the enemy under these circumstances." 4 hours later, he made essentially the same report. Thus, for the rebel General McLaws, whose brigades had fought hard twice, once at Maryland Heights and once at Crampton's Gap, a moment of serendipity. In the afternoon, he and his command marched down to the Potomac and across the pontoon bridge and into Harper's Ferry, while his enemies looked on, helplessly now, from a distance. Chapter 41 The Blood-Washed Ground. For Robert E. Lee, the news that Jackson had seized Harper's Ferry changed almost everything. He could reunite his army, he could stand and fight. His lines of communication and path of retreat were secure. What it did not change was that, on the morning of September 15, the day of Jackson's victory, Lee was still isolated, alone, and more vulnerable than he had ever been. He therefore did the only thing he could possibly do, facing the bulk of McClellan's victorious army with a mere 15,000 men. He bluffed and waited for Jackson. After his retreat from South Mountain, Lee had chosen the best defensive position he could find on short notice, on the flanks of the 12-block rural town of Sharpsburg, about 8 rolling country miles west of Turner's Gap. He placed his men on a long, undulating ridge that ran from 3 miles north of the village to 1.5 miles southeast of it. This was all high ground. Behind him, at a distance of roughly 1 mile at its nearest point, was the Potomac River. From the ridge, the land sloped gently down and eastward in a swelling plateau of open pastures, cultivated fields, and woodlots to Antietam Creek, which ran generally about 1 mile west of the ridge. At its northernmost point, the line of ridges touched the Potomac. On the far south, it met the westward looping creek. Lee's position behind Antietam Creek was in most ways a risky proposition. Its main advantages were the natural elevation of the ridge and the limited creek crossings available to the Union troops, 4 arched stone bridges, which could be swept by Lee's batteries. The disadvantages were striking, even to a casual observer. The most obvious weakness was that Lee had backed his army up against a major river, as Colonel Edward Porter Alexander of Lee's staff pointed out, with no bridge and only 1 ford, and that the worst one on the whole river. He had, in effect, done exactly what John Pope had done, before the latter realized the egregiousness of his mistake and corrected it, in placing his army between the Rapidan and the Rappahannock 1 month before, except that Pope at least had access to a bridge. There was, moreover, only 1 road to Boatler's Ford, the only nearby crossing, which ran along high bluffs for much of the 2 miles south from Sharpsburg, and was so narrow at points that, as Alexander observed, a horseman could not easily pass a wagon. The ford itself was deep and rocky. No army, Alexander said, only a bit hyperbolically, could retreat over such a road as that under fire. Lee, an astute student of terrain who would have understood this as well as anyone, had presumably decided, with considerable contempt for his opponent's abilities, that there was little chance that his army would be retreating across the Potomac under fire. Then there was the length of Lee's line itself, more than 4 miles. Even with his full army, or what was left of it, he did not have enough manpower to adequately defend all of the ground from the Potomac to the Antietam. He thus had a built-in weakness from the start. His lines were stretched thin in places, and his left was not really anchored on the Potomac at all. It was in the air, and in spite of the artillery Lee mounted on a northern hill, it would remain that way. For now, the charade was all that mattered. Lee spread his paper-thin lines across a wide front and fired his guns at whatever Federals showed themselves on the other side of the creek, or at nothing in particular. He was openly and defiantly offering battle to McClellan, which, in view of McClellan's intimate knowledge of Confederate plans, must have puzzled him. Jackson, McLaws, and Walker couldn't possibly have arrived yet, could they? But a perplexed McClellan was a cautious and fearful McClellan, and that was precisely what Lee wanted. September 15 passed, and with it one of the truly spectacular military opportunities of the war. McClellan had told William Franklin earlier that he wanted to cut the enemy in two and beat him in detail. Here was that opportunity, or half of it anyway. And he passed on it. He was again the victim of his own inflated estimate of Lee's troop strength. He later testified that the rebels had about 100,000 men, instead of somewhat fewer than 40,000. His lieutenants were in rough agreement. His loyal friend and principal advisor, Fitzjohn Porter, pegged the number at 100,000 to 130,000, Edwin Sumner at 80,000. McClellan's dithering wasn't entirely without its advantages. It did give him more time to concentrate his available forces, including Franklin's Sixth Corps, for an attack. September 16 came, and with it yet another opportunity to crush Lee, and still the Union forces stayed put. McClellan busied himself with the things he loved best, reconnaissance, placing batteries, assigning bivouacs, checking on his supplies of food and ordnance. The pause allowed Jackson, who had taken his men on a severe forced march overnight, to join Lee's battle line at midday, a mirror image of Lee's dramatic arrival near Manassas. It must have given both men pleasure in a purely tactical sense to be able to again unite their forces in such a dramatic way under the noses of the enemy. In spite of their rough, 17-mile journey, Jackson's men were still flushed with victory when they arrived at Sharpsburg. For such a ragged, underfed lot, they were astoundingly cheerful. Bands played Dixie while thousands of Confederate soldiers sang its words. Such inspiring, soul-stirring music I never heard as the volume of harmony rolled and thundered through that little vale in the forest, wrote William T. Pogue, a gunner with Jackson's Rockbridge Artillery. It seemed to put new life into both men and animals as we followed old Jack through the village. We felt ready for anything our beloved general might undertake. One wonders what the Yankee pickets, who had been told that the Confederate Army was reeling from its defeat at South Mountain, in a panic and on the run, its generals wounded or dead, made of such high spirits. Jackson seemed to be in a good mood, too, though as usual that did not mean a sudden burst of warm feeling toward his colleagues in the upper ranks. He'd been feuding again with his general officers. On September 4, after he had personally countermanded A.P. Hill's order to his troops, which appeared to contradict his own, Hill had approached him in a fury, pulled his sword from its scabbard, turned the hilt toward Jackson, and said, "I submit my resignation, sir." Jackson ignored the proffered sword and said quietly, "General Hill, consider yourself under arrest for disobedience of orders." For the next several days, Hill repeatedly asked Jackson to give him a written copy of the charges against him. Jackson refused. He informed Hill, through an aide, that should his case come before a court-martial, the charges would be furnished to him. This made Hill even madder. It was only on September 10, 6 days later, that Hill received permission to return to the command of his division. Still, Jackson would not drop the charges. His fight with Hill may not have been entirely the result of Jackson's quirky style of command. Henry Kidd Douglas, for one, believed that the feisty, independent Hill, who hadn't liked Jackson since their earliest days at West Point, had it coming to him. While in Frederick, Jackson placed another general, William E. Stark, in arrest for allowing his Louisiana troops to take goods from local shops without paying for them. When it turned out that the guilty parties were actually from the Stonewall Brigade, Jackson released Stark from arrest, but he never apologized or even noted his mistake. In spite of his harsh treatment of his generals, Jackson could, as usual, be surprisingly kind, and even funny in his own peculiar way, even under the immense pressure of the march from Harper's Ferry. When he arrived in Sharpsburg, a local citizen invited him to breakfast. He declined, but the daughter of the house sent food to him anyway. Jackson, who was glad to get it, asked his aide Henry Kidd Douglas who the sender was. "I don't know, General, but it was the fair one." "Well, as she sent me my breakfast to the field, I will call her Miss Fairfield." Amused at this conceit, Jackson then took a pencil and wrote, "Sharpsburg, September 16, 1862. Miss Fairfield, I have received a nice breakfast, for which I am indebted to your kindness. Please accept my grateful appreciation of your hospitality. Very sincerely yours, T.J. Jackson." At 4 p.m. on the afternoon of September 16, McClellan finally made his first very tentative move. Major General Joseph Hooker crossed Antietam Creek with his 3-division, 14,000-man First Corps, swept around to the north end of Lee's line, and advanced in what amounted to a reconnaissance in force. His batteries opened, and his infantry drove in the rebel skirmishers until the resistance stiffened, revealing the rough contours of the main Confederate line of resistance astride the north-to-south running Hagerstown Pike. Hooker now knew more or less where the rebel line was, and there he stopped. Less happily, from a tactical standpoint, he had also revealed to Lee the position and direction of the opening attack of the Battle of Antietam the next morning. Joe Hooker was the sort of general Abraham Lincoln was looking for. He was tall, good-looking, clean-shaven in a sea of military beards, forthright, transparently ambitious, and conspicuously brave. Though there were rumors of hard drinking and womanizing, his personal habits did not seem to interfere with his martial talents. He liked to lead from the front, and had thus earned the moniker Fighting Joe. He had indeed fought hard and well in the Peninsula Campaign, which had earned him promotion. It chafed under McClellan's cautious leadership. At about dawn on September 17, mounted on a muscular milk-white charger, he ordered the first attack of the Battle of Antietam. His objective? A slightly raised piece of open ground just east of the Hagerstown Pike, where, on the flank of a plain, four-square German Baptist church, their habit of baptism by total immersion had led to their nickname Dunkers, stood thick ranks of Confederate cannons. This was the heart of the Confederate left, the wing of Lee's army that was under the command of Stonewall Jackson. Hooker attacked after daybreak. His troops came straight at Jackson's 2 divisions under Generals Alexander Lawton, taking the wounded Ewell's place, and John R. Jones in a north-to-south assault across a half-mile-wide front. 1 Union division under Abner Doubleday moved along the axis of the turnpike near the West Woods. Another, under James Ricketts, moved from the East Woods across a prim 30-acre cornfield. With Doubleday were those damn black hat fellers, as the Stonewall Brigade called the men who had earned the name Iron Brigade on this battlefield. On they came, as big Union 20-pounders detonated east of Antietam Creek, and Hooker's guns fired first solid shot and exploding shell, shrapnel, then case, exploding spheres that shot 100 bullets forward on detonation, and finally double-shotted canister from the front. From Nicodemus Hill on the west near the Potomac, artillery under Jeb Stuart poured in destructive fire from the Union flank, ripping holes in the Iron Brigade and others. Jackson's battle line stood mostly on open ground, starting just north of the Dunker Church and stretching 1/2 mile from the West Woods through the southern part of the cornfield. As the lines engaged, it seemed to the combatants as though the world had exploded into a storm of buzzing iron and lead. The bluecoats came ahead anyway with breathtaking resolve, striding forward in line, stopping, peering through the moving wall of white smoke, tearing cartridges with their teeth, loading, ramming, firing, and as often as not, falling screaming to the ground. When the first of them emerged from the corn rows, a line of rebel infantry rose and dropped much of the line where it stood, as a scythe moves through wheat. A Confederate shell, landing in the midst of the 6th Wisconsin Regiment, exploding as it struck, took out as many as 30 men. The battle was as intimate as it was violent, fought at close range by men who could see each other clearly, a free-for-all in the choking fog and smoke and heat, with attacks and counterattacks coming from seemingly every direction. There was something fearless and primitive and elemental in the combat that morning, a kind of madness or possession, as soldiers left their humanity behind and became mere feral killing machines. By 7 a.m., an hour into the fight, Jackson had fought Hooker to a horrific standstill. The losses sustained by both sides, measured as the percentage of a regiment that had fallen, were already unprecedented in the war. But the Confederates were starting to wobble. Division Commander Lawton could feel it and told Jackson as much. In response, Jackson summoned John Bell Hood's 2,300-man division of troops from Texas, Mississippi, Georgia, and the Carolinas, generally considered the toughest fighters in Lee's army. They had been in a reserve position behind the lines, where they had just been given their first rations in 3 days, and were sitting down to enjoy them. Infuriated at the interruption, they marched to the front, and with the predominantly Texas brigade in the lead and the weirdly barking, yipping, whirring noise of the rebel yell echoing across the killing ground, smashed into the Federals and drove them sharply back. The effect of Hood's counterattack was stunning and immediate. The Federals reeled, turned, then split right and left for the cover of the woods, with Hood's men in hot pursuit. The fight raged in the cornfield and along the turnpike. It spilled into the East Woods and the West Woods, where men faced fire from several directions, and there was more of that wild, fierce, close-range combat between men who, obeying some instinct that transcended all reason, would not run away. But Hood could not beat the Union Army by himself. As his men rolled triumphantly into the northern end of the cornfield, resistance stiffened, and once again they were in that tornado of canister and miniballs, hearing the sickening dull thuds of lead and iron hitting flesh. The entire field by this time was shrouded in opaque, greasy smoke, in places so thick that the only things visible were the waving battle flags. At one point, a Pennsylvania regiment took aim at the oncoming 1st Texas, resting their muskets on the lower rails of a fence and shooting at the Texans' legs, which were all they could see. The Texans soon broke and retreated through the incessant and deafening musket fire, leaving an appalling 80% of their comrades lying on the ground. Thus the prototype of surge and counter-surge that defined the fighting that morning. The advances would start strong, out of musket range, with the full support of their main artillery. But as the men moved forward into the fray, several factors came into play. There was the inevitable loss of men to enemy fire. At Antietam, this could be upward of half of a fighting unit. The advancing companies and regiments also became disorganized as terrain separated men, or they became disoriented in the swirling smoke, or even, more critically, lost their field commanders. As they approached the enemy, of course, they moved farther and farther away from their own artillery, which at some point could no longer fire without hitting them, and closer to the enemy's shotgun-like canisters. And finally, they actually hit the enemy's defensive line itself, often stocked with fresh reserves. And then the momentum changed, and the enemy came on. After an hour of frenzied fighting on a field now washed in blood, Hooker's and Jackson's corps seemed less coherent fighting units than assemblages of human wreckage. Half of the Confederates in Lawton's 3 brigades had been killed or wounded. Lawton himself had been wounded. One of his brigade commanders was dead, and 11 of 15 regimental commanders were killed or wounded. A third of the men in Jackson's old division were lying on the field. Their commander, Brigadier General John R. Jones, was wounded, and his replacement, William E. Stark, was dead. Hood lost 60% of his men. When he was asked where his command was, he replied, dead on the field. On the Union side, Hooker's First Corps lost 2,600 men, or a third of its strength. Hooker himself was wounded. One of his division commanders, Brigadier General James Ricketts, who had 3,150 men at his disposal at the beginning of the fight, could muster only 300, a combined result of casualties, straggling, and battlefield dislocations. Hooker's own description of the fighting in the Corn captures the effects of its animal violence. In the time I am writing, every stalk of corn in the northern and greater part of the field was cut as closely as with a knife, and the slain lay in rows precisely as they had stood in their ranks a few minutes before. It was never my fortune to witness a more bloody, dismal battlefield. The First Corps was, for the moment, fought out. But the fight on the Confederate left was far from over. While Jackson had already used up his main reserve, Hood's division, McClellan still had enormous firepower waiting to enter the battle. Onto the field now marched Major General Joseph Mansfield's 12th Corps, which had been biding its time just north and east of the cornfield. Mansfield was a white-haired Army lifer, an engineer by training who had never had a combat command and had lobbied incessantly for this one in the preceding months. He was commanding a corps that consisted mostly of the men who had fought with Nathaniel Banks in the valley. He should have been ordered to attack with Hooker. Two full Federal corps might have turned the rebel left, but McClellan gave no such orders. This was to be the pattern of the day's Union attacks, piecemeal and without coordination, thus failing to capitalize on the enormous Federal advantage in numbers. As Hood's attack lost steam, Mansfield's 12th Corps advanced, driving the bloodied, exhausted rebels back, 7,200 fresh troops sweeping south over the same ground that had been fought over all morning. This was at about 7:30 a.m., half an hour after Hood's slashing counterattack, and 90 minutes into the fighting. From his command post in the West Woods, Jackson worked furiously in the rising pandemonium to hold off disaster. He reformed scattered units, repositioned artillery, moved Stuart's guns nearer to his main force, sent batteries to the rear to be refurbished, and brought up new supplies of ammunition. He replaced part of Lawton's broken division with a brigade borrowed from D.H. Hill in the Confederate center and deployed it across the cornfield. He brought Jubal Early's brigade up from the flank and positioned it in the West Woods. He brought what was left of Hood's division and set it up as a reserve on his right. But the momentum had already swung hard in the Union's favor. The 12th Corps seemed to move at will, driving not only the remnants of Jones, Lawton, and Hood, but also the borrowed brigades from D.H. Hill near the East Woods. Even worse, Jackson had no more troops to bring into the battle. He had foreseen this when he had first seen Hood forward, and had asked Lee for reinforcements as early as 7 a.m. Lee had answered that he would send him the divisions of McLaws and Walker. Those reinforcements had not yet arrived. The 12th Corps was now in possession of the battlefield and most of the ground from the East Woods to the West Woods. Disaster suddenly loomed on the Confederate left. All that remained, it seemed, was for Colonel Andrew Grigsby's Stonewall Brigade and Jubal Early's Brigade, maybe 1,400 men, to mount the rebels' last stand. The only good news, had they been aware of it, was that both Union Corps commanders, Mansfield and Hooker, were wounded. Hooker, severely in the foot, and Mansfield mortally in the chest. But the situation was worse than Jackson had imagined. At about 9 a.m., as he waited for the 12th Corps to mount yet another attack, he saw something even more disturbing off in the distance. From the vicinity of the East Woods, across the mangled cornfield, suddenly appeared a massive, fast-moving column of blue. Though he could not identify it, this was the lead division of Major General Edwin Sumner's 2nd Corps, led by Sumner himself, whose objective was to smash the Confederate left once and for all. Or at least that is what Sumner intended. His execution of this worthy plan, however, was nothing short of bizarre. Edwin Sumner was the very picture of the old warhorse. At 65, he was the oldest of the old Army officers in McClellan's force. He was crusty and tough and old school and famous for his booming voice, which had given him the nickname Bull. He was a stand-up fighter and unquestionably brave, the sort of man you would send to take a heavily defended hill. But he was not terribly smart, and the range of his thought was remarkably narrow. He was coming across the field now at the head of the 5,500 men under Division Commander John Sedgwick. It was at this moment that while Early and Grigsby prepared to make the Confederate left's last stand in the West Woods, Jackson's long-awaited reinforcements began to arrive. Half an hour later, he might have been overrun. But Lee, with his knack for inserting soldiers into battles at the right place and at the right time, had come through. Sumner, meanwhile, convinced that the rebel flank was vulnerable, and from his reconnaissance it did indeed look that way, proposed to move into and through the West Woods north of the Dunker Church, then wheel to the left and sweep down on the rebel lines from the north. To do this, he had formed Sedgwick's division into three classic, two-deep battle lines, each 500 yards long and separated by 30 to 50 yards. Thus deployed, unsupported by other Union forces, and ignoring the scattered fighting units of the 1st and 12th Corps around them, they came rapidly on. Such a marching formation was appropriate to a parade ground or a military review. On this battlefield, it amounted to suicide. There was absolutely no preparation for facing to the right or left in case either of their exposed flanks should be attacked, wrote Francis W. Palfrey, then a lieutenant colonel with the 20th Massachusetts. The total disregard of all ordinary military precaution in their swift and solitary advance was so manifest that it was observed and criticized as the devoted band moved on. Unfortunately for Sedgwick's men, Jackson had understood immediately how exposed they were. And now, thanks to Lee, he had the reinforcements to do something about it. He moved them quickly into place, both inside and to the west of the West Woods. He began by orchestrating some 4,400 men into both a frontal and a flank assault on the 125th Pennsylvania near the Dunker Church. Soon the Pennsylvanians were reeling out of the woods in full retreat. This was the first move in Jackson's counterstroke. To prevent Sumner from turning his left, he moved one of McLaws's brigades to the western side of the woods. He ordered the brigades fighting the 125th Pennsylvania to break off their attack and move north in the woods to intercept the east-to-west advancing Sumner. Jackson had his battle line in place literally moments before Sumner's advancing battle lines appeared in the open lot that was inset west of the Hagerstown Road and north of the main woods. The Union troops under Sedgwick and Sumner, marching forward in their three textbook battle lines, apparently did not see what was waiting for them in the woods. They kept moving. And now the woods exploded. Suddenly there was a great roar and tumult of musketry and screaming men, and bullets were everywhere as the Confederate artillery, somehow positioned perfectly to smash the Second Corps, boomed from behind the woods. Confederate riflemen, firing from behind uneven ground and limestone ledges, swept the three sets of double Union lines with volley after volley. Rebel batteries opened from the west, adding shell and canister to the melee. Eventually, Stuart's artillery also joined in. Barksdale's Mississippians and Early's Virginians emerged into the open space along the pike and slammed into Sumner's trailing brigades, and soon Sumner's entire force was engulfed in fire. Sumner, at the head of his troops, finally grasped just how close to annihilation he was. "Back, boys! For God's sake, move back! You're in a bad fix." But it was too late to save them. Union brigade commanders tried vainly to get their troops to change front, but all that ensued was a mass tangle of confused and panicked men as all regimental order vanished and the Federals nearest the woods simply broke and ran. The lines tended to compress too, which offered a conspicuous mass of blue-clad human flesh for the rebels to shoot at. Things only got worse from there. Regiments collapsed like dominoes. Where the Federals had been hit first on their flank, now they faced fire from front, rear, and flank, trapped in the lethal three-sided box that Jackson had prepared for them. "A terrific fire of musketry opened in the woods in Sumner's front across the pike," wrote Black Hat Brigade Commander John Gibbon. "Instantly, as it appeared to me, the whole open space between the east and west woods was filled with a disorganized mass of panic-stricken men going to the rear. 2,300 Union soldiers fell in 15 minutes in the fight that would soon be known as the Westwoods Massacre. That is 5 men every 2 seconds. Union Division Commander John Sedgwick was wounded 3 times and carried from the field. Though Jackson's men tried to follow their success with another attack across the cornfield against the Eastwoods, they soon found themselves being blasted by canister from 50 Union guns. They stopped and drifted back. A Union attempt to relieve Sumner faltered too, this time met by troops from Walker's division, who had also arrived just at the right time to meet the Federal advance. The lone exception to Jackson's sweeping success was the stubborn 12th Corps Brigade commanded by Brigadier General George Sears, which had captured the Dunker Church and actually moved 200 yards beyond it into the West Woods. He somehow managed to keep his precious foothold. It was the original objective of the Union attack that morning, all the while calling for reinforcements and utterly unaware that the Union 2nd Corps had been completely routed. He discovered this unpleasant fact at about noon, and shortly before Jackson's troops blasted him on both flanks, driving him back. Though the guns and muskets continued to roar, the Federals seemed to be more concerned with self-preservation than breaking the rebel line. At this point, the battle had lasted for 4 hours. Jackson had been assaulted by 2 full Union corps and the lead division of another in successive waves that cost 12,000 casualties on both sides. He had initially lost so much ground that he was in danger of being swallowed outright by advancing Federal forces. But by shrewd deployment of the reserves Lee sent him, at the end of the day, "My troops held the ground which they had occupied in the morning," Jackson wrote in his battle report. McClellan had not gained an inch of terrain. During all this, Jackson, from behind the Dunker Church, was a study in motion, watching the battlefield, directing the fire of his batteries, exhorting his men, issuing orders. John S. Mosby, a cavalryman who observed Jackson briefly, was amazed at how he seemed transfigured with the joy of battle as he issued orders in a quiet way. Jackson later told D.H. Hill that he never felt safer than in the firestorm at Antietam. He was convinced that God would protect him and that no harm would befall him. Jackson's achievement was all the more remarkable because he had done it in spite of the absence of key generals, A.P. Hill, en route from Harper's Ferry, Richard Ewell, wounded at 2nd Manassas, Isaac Trimble, wounded at 2nd Manassas, and Charles S. Winder, killed at Cedar Mountain, and the fact that 8 of his 14 brigades were commanded by colonels with little experience. Just as important, his performance at Antietam showed that he had clearly mastered the role of executive officer, subordinate to Lee on the field, yet working closely with him, taking initiative when he needed to, cooperating with other generals, and deftly managing his side of the battlefield. If this particular martial skill was sometimes lacking during the 7 days, the fights at Antietam and 2nd Manassas proved that he had learned to operate within an army as well as in independent command. His personal presence on the battlefield had become a critical component of Confederate success. 30 miles away, where Richard Ewell was recovering from the amputation of his leg after his wounding at Manassas, and hearing the distant sound of artillery at Sharpsburg, he became extremely agitated and finally confessed to his doctor that he could not listen to the battle without worrying that Jackson would be killed. The future of the Confederacy, he believed, depended in large part on his chief's survival. At noon, Surgeon Hunter McGuire met Jackson at his command post behind the lines at the Dunker Church. McGuire was eating one of the peaches a local woman had given him. Jackson's face brightened when he saw his favorite fruit. "Do you have any more?" he asked. McGuire gave Jackson several pieces, which he consumed immediately and with great relish. He apologized to McGuire for his gluttony, saying it was the first food he had eaten all day. "Can our line hold against another attack?" asked McGuire, surveying a field littered with the dead and dying. "I think they have done their worst," Jackson answered calmly. "There's now no danger of the line being broken." Jackson, who had a remarkable ability to read a battlefield through the smoke and thunder and chaos of a fight, turned out to be right. There would not be another attack. The battle on the Confederate left, and Jackson's part in the Battle of Antietam, was over. That afternoon, he and Jeb Stuart would, under Lee's orders, gather troops for an advance against the 1st, 6th, and 12th Corps. But the two men would decide very quickly that they did not have nearly the numbers or firepower to pull it off. Meanwhile, as the roar of musket and artillery fire to their right attested, the fight was just beginning for James Longstreet and the rest of Lee's army. George McClellan was worried. After what had happened to him in the morning, he had good reason to be. He had sent three army corps to turn the rebel flank. They'd been badly mauled, and at midday the defiant rebel left stood exactly where it had been when Hooker's first assault began. What had gone wrong? From the luxury of the rear, well behind the creek, surrounded by his reserves of more than 30,000 men, it was hard to tell. McClellan's headquarters was in a large house on a commanding elevation, where the scene in and around it was as unlike Jackson's primitive, artillery-raked command post behind the Dunker Church as it could possibly be. "Here was the immense cavalry escort waiting in the rear," wrote Captain George F. Noyes, a staffer with Division Commander Brigadier General Abner Doubleday. "Staff horses picketed by dozens around the house, while the piazza was crowded with officers seeking to read with their field glasses the history of the battle at the right." At the center of all this sat McClellan, almost preternaturally calm, conversing quietly with staff members, consulting Fitzjohn Porter as usual, sending and receiving messages, and gazing through a telescope to try to make sense of what was happening. But according to Noyes, it was almost impossible to see anything, even from a vantage point several hundred yards closer to the front. "I could not distinguish a single battery," wrote Noyes, "nor discern the movements of a single brigade, nor see a single battalion of the men in gray. Smoke clouds leaped in sudden fury from ridges crowned with cannon, or lay thick and dim upon the valleys, or rose lazily up over the trees. All else was concealed. Only the volleyed thunder was eloquent." The fact was that through those great shifting pools and shrouds of smoke, the battle was already spinning out of McClellan's control. He had not intended to break off his attack on the rebel left, but that attack had extinguished itself, partly because many Union commanders were wounded, partly through simple battlefield attrition, and partly because of the extreme havoc that had been wrought on regimental and brigade-level organization. Not only that, but one of Sumner's 2nd Corps divisions, under the stout red-faced William H. French, Jackson's old Florida nemesis, who had earned the nickname Blinky for his habit of rapidly fluttering his eyes when he spoke, that was supposed to follow him into the field, had lost sight of Sumner, and instead moved obliquely south and west, driving into the Confederate center and touching off a battle there. McClellan's purpose in attacking the rebel left had been to turn it, if possible, but in any case to force Lee to shift troops from the rest of his line, thus weakening his center and right. This was exactly what had happened. Lee had actually thrown nearly three-fourths of his available force into Jackson's fight. Unfortunately, McClellan's spyglass did not reveal this astonishing fact to him. What was more, in spite of his 9 a.m. orders to Major General Ambrose Burnside and his 9th Corps on his far left to cross the creek and move against Lee's right, Burnside still seemed frozen in place. To McClellan, this was all very unsettling. Antietam was really three battles, fought more or less sequentially on September 17, between dawn and dusk. The first of these was the four-hour Hooker-Jackson Donnybrook in the north. The second, just as frenzied and recklessly violent, took place in the center. At about 9:30, while Jackson was demolishing Sumner in the West Woods, French's 5,700 Union troops advanced against the 2,500 rebels under D.H. Hill, who were deployed within the embankments of the Sunken Road, a small dirt lane used by farmers that had been worn down over the years by rain and wagon wheels. From its first moment, Hill's Confederates opened fire at a range of 60 yards and took out 450 of the 1,400 men in French's lead brigade. The rebels held most of the advantages. They were firing from superb cover, and they were closely supported by artillery. The Yankee troops had neither. They stood and delivered from 80 yards out, one brigade at a time, and went down by the hundreds.